is Edinburgh Student Radio Station.
I would listen to this.
This is Fresh Air!
Good evening. The time is 6:08 and you're listening to the Fresh Air News Hour. My name is Ollie Lewis. I am Fresh Air's head of news and I'm with you until 7 o'clock, taking you through the biggest stories of the week. We are live from Edinburgh. Here's what's coming up on the show. Well, there really is only one story in town, isn't there? COP26, the Global Climate Summit, has been taking place in Glasgow this week. World leaders have descended on Scotland to try and solve what many believe to be the gravest fear ever faced. Now, how have the leaders performed in that so far? Have their speeches met the moment? More importantly, have their actions done what is needed to turn the tide on climate change? As well as overall analysis of the event, we'll be looking at COP from a student perspective. Fresh Air News has been on the ground in Glasgow, speaking to activists and other young people getting involved. And finally, what on earth is going on in the House of Commons? This afternoon, we've had a Tory MP resign and a Labour MP given a suspended sentence in two separate incidents. We'll bring you up to speed on that. Now, luckily for you, I won't be alone in all of this. I'm delighted to be joined by this week's co-host on the News Hour, Bridget. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
It's great to be with you. Let's get some news headlines before we begin in just a moment. Conservative MP Owen Paterson has resigned from the House of Commons. An independent committee found him guilty of breaching standards when he lobbied on behalf of a company for which he was paid a total of approximately £500,000 over a number of years. Yesterday, the government passed a motion to reform the committee in the wake of the findings and then faced accusations of trying to protect Mr. Paterson from the implications of his wrongdoing. This afternoon, the government U-turned, saying the committee would remain in place and Mr. Paterson would be sanctioned for his actions. Separately, Labour MP Claudia Webb has been given a 10-week suspended jail sentence for threatening to throw acid over a friend of her partner. She has been expelled from the Labour Party but intends to appeal the decision. The International Energy Agency has said that if the promises made so far at COP26 are kept, global warming could be kept to around 1.8 degrees above pre-industrial levels. More than 40 countries have today committed to shift away from coal usage, however significant users such as India and the USA are not part of the pledge. And the first pill that can be used to treat COVID-19 has been approved by the UK's medicine regulator. The Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, has called the move a game changer. It is thought that it will protect the most vulnerable from the disease. It's currently 10 minutes past six. Well, good evening. Welcome back to the News Hour. As I said, my name is Ollie Lewis. It's great to be with you and, as we also said, I'm not alone in the studio. Bridget is with me. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
I'm so excited to be back. We did our first news show last week. I was joined by Rosa. And this week we're putting together what is sort of billed to be a sort of COP26 special, isn't it? What are we going to be looking at today?
Yeah, so we're definitely going to be looking at everything that's happened so far at COP26, any of the agreements that have been made, any kind of significant messages we've had. I know that one of the things we want to talk about is the Queen's message and other kind of important global figures who were there, such as Greta Thunberg. We'll also be chatting about the kind of breaking news story at the moment in the House of Commons. Yeah, I'm excited to be part of the show.
Absolutely. It's brilliant to have you with us. So It's been a strange one, actually, this week to see all these world leaders and their entourages and their security and their advisors all descend on Scotland and on Glasgow,
definitely.
Of course. We had Joe Biden, the president of the US, landing on Air Force One into Edinburgh Airport, of course, local to us here. And it has felt like a big one, hasn't it? It has had sort of the same tone as Paris in 2015 did. Paris really felt like a watershed moment in terms of climate policy, in terms of people caring about the issue. And I think one of the main differences actually between Paris in 2015, which was of course when the target to reduce emissions by 1.5 degrees was set, the main difference between that and now, I think, has been the sort of overall acceptance that climate change is a grave threat. and that action is, needs to be done. I saw a member of President Biden's White House team on climate, that specializes on climate, saying that the difference that's really changed over the last 10 years is that apart from the fringes of certain political parties, they are no longer fighting off climate skeptics in terms of mainstream policymakers. Would you agree with that? Do you think that's the main tonal shift that we've seen?
Definitely, yeah. I think we've really seen so many world leaders who've actually come together to say, this is a problem. We all acknowledge it's a problem. And what we're doing, instead of debating, you know, is it an issue? How can we concede it? Is actually saying, what can be done? I think that's really been the massive tonal shift. Yeah, and it's exciting to see.
Yeah, it is. And of course, I would argue that one of those who has shifted the greatest on this is our Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. Let's have a listen to what he said in his opening speech earlier this week.
Welcome to Glasgow and to Scotland, whose most globally famous fictional son is almost certainly a man called James Bond, who generally comes to the climax of his highly lucrative film strapped to a doomsday device, desperately trying to work out which coloured wire to pull to turn it off, while a red digital clock ticks down remorselessly to a detonation that will end human life as we know it. And we are in roughly the same position, my fellow global leaders, as James Bond.
Same position as James Bond. That is quite a different tone, I might say, that Boris Johnson took from when, in 2015, at Paris, when he said, and I quote, "I'm sure that the leaders who were in Paris were driven by a primitive fear that the present ambient warm weather is somehow caused by humanity. And that fear, as I understand the science, is without foundation." It's an interesting shift, isn't
it? Wow, that's a massive shift. Yeah, I guess one of the things that's important is the whole climate change movement has really taken off in the 6 years we've had. Mm-hmm. We've had the school strikes, we've had Extinction Rebellion, we've had motorways, you know, things being closed down. There's a lot of direct action. But also, I suppose part of it is following, you know, Brexit in 2016, I think it's clear that Boris Johnson is really faced with the need of making alliances with other leaders who aren't European, the US, for example. And I think he knows that if he's to make those alliances, he needs to step up on climate change.
And do you think that if President Trump were still in power in the US, he would be taking a different tone on this?
Absolutely, yeah. I think Biden's message really during COP26 was that America is back. You know, America is wanting to make these alliances, wanting to work with other countries, wanting to make compromises. You know, I think when he criticised China and Russia for not being part of the summit, I think he was also saying, you know, come on, guys, let's work on this together. And even if we don't agree politically on other things, you know, like we've said earlier, the climate is one thing that isn't left or right wing. It's something that now we've all agreed on. So I think that if Trump was there, the tone would be a lot more kind of isolationist. You know, this is what America's doing. We've done enough. Maybe there's not as much interest in what the other countries are doing. But I think Biden's approach is kind of bringing countries into the tent more. And so I think Boris then, in turn, is kind of responding to that.
Just before we move on the point of sort of organisational issues around COP, there have been quite bad media reports about the way it's been organised. We've seen pictures of hour-long queues for journalists and delegates to get in, some of which resulted in them missing meetings and that kind of thing. We've had criticism from some people that Dettol has been the key provider of antibacterial hand wash and that kind of thing because their parent company is linked in some manner to the fossil fuel industry. Do you think, in terms of imagery, the summit so far has gone well in terms of presenting the good face of the UK?
No, I wouldn't say so.
You wouldn't? Okay, interesting. Why?
Well, as well, the story with the minister who wasn't able to, you know, access those talks because of a disability, and, you know, Boris's subsequent apology.
A huge issue there. That was, the Israeli negotiator who was here and couldn't get into the conference for a number of hours because she was in a wheelchair.
Yeah, it's significant. And as well, I think, you know, that there were strikes as well that were threatened, the train strikes, you know, overcrowding. Yeah, I think you do get the impression that it's not been the most, I don't know, well-run summit.
Okay, well, someone certainly attempting to change that perception is Her Majesty the Queen, and the royal family have been involved in COP. Let's just have a quick listen to her message to delegates, which was delivered virtually, of course.
I'm delighted to welcome you all to the 26th United Nations Climate Change Conference. And it is perhaps fitting that you have come together in Glasgow, once heartland of the Industrial Revolution, but now a place to address climate change. It is a source of great pride to me that the leading role my husband played in encouraging people to protect our fragile planet lives on through the work of our eldest son, Charles, and his eldest son, William. I could not be more proud of them. Indeed, I have drawn great comfort and inspiration from the relentless enthusiasm of people of all ages, especially the young, in calling for everyone to play their part. None of us underestimates the challenges ahead, but history has shown that when nations come together in common cause, there is always room for hope. I, for one, hope that this conference will be one of those rare occasions where everyone will have the chance to rise above the politics of the moment and achieve true statesmanship. It is the hope of many that the legacy of this summit, written in history books yet to be printed, will describe you as the leaders who did not pass up the opportunity, and that you answered the call of those future generations. Of course, the benefits of such actions will not be there to enjoy for all of us here today. We none of us will live forever. But we are doing this not for ourselves, but for our children and our children's children, and those who will follow in their footsteps.
Now, the line that strikes me there is, we none of us will live forever.
Yeah,
and that is, of
absolutely.
Course, the message of the summit, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What is your view, Bridget, on the role of the royal family in climate action? Because they are very present. Mm. Prince Charles has been known as being ahead of his time on this issue. His son, as the Queen said, Prince William, has been absolutely involved, especially lately. He's set up his Earthshot Prize, which is being done in accordance with David Attenborough. What's your view on the royals being involved in all of this?
Well, I'd say it's fairly mixed. I think on the one hand, you know, the royals, they're not elected. They arguably, at a summit of politicians and delegates, they arguably don't have, you know, the kind of power given to them by the people to be able to give instructions, you know, to be able to say, you must do this. They don't have that power. They're not elected. But on the other hand, I guess it shows, as, you know, the conference itself shows, that certain issues have to transcend party boundaries. And, you know, as we were talking about earlier, it's now the case that climate change is being recognised as a real thing, and the conversation shifted to how to deal with it. So I guess whilst it's not ideal to have the royal family kind of talking about issues which politicians decide on, it does make sense that they're kind of a force in the discussion, just to kind of compel people to keep it in their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose the other thing is that Britain is kind of increasingly alone in being a country on the world stage that has a monarchy. You know, every country is kind of moving towards republicanism. And so maybe the monarchy has a kind of soft power amongst other countries, amongst delegates. I mean, you know, the Queen still has a role in the Commonwealth. So I guess in a sense, I kind of think, you know, it's a cause in which I'm okay for the monarchy to participate in, but yeah, it wouldn't be the same with other causes.
Interesting. That's very interesting. What, in your view, is the inherent difference between the monarchy being involved in this conversation and someone else who's unelected, let's say David Attenborough?
That's true. Yeah, I suppose maybe because there are certain people such as David Attenborough who seem to have spent their lives dedicated to the movement, or dedicated, not maybe the movement specifically, but the environment, to the case of conservation.
Yeah, he's dedicated himself to showing the world the things that a lot of people couldn't see via the means of television.
Yeah, and he has a role as a kind of presenter and journalist, and, you know, he's kind of been in the industry for a while. Whereas I suppose the royals, to us, we don't associate them with a cause or with work or something like that. We just sort of see them as people who are kind of there to, you know, have certain roles and certain jobs, but not necessarily to identify themselves with something or to say that something is good or bad. I suppose that's maybe where the difference lies.
Interesting. Well, we will have much more discussion about COP26 on this special edition of the Fresh Air News Hour. But as always, we promise that the News Hour will not be just an hour of news and discussion, as interesting as that might be, but we will intersperse it with some joyful music for your Thursday evening. The evenings are getting sort of very long, very dark, and it's important to keep spirits up. So we'll be back after this. This is the 1975 with Give Yourself a Try. You're listening to Fresh Air Radio. That was the 1975 with Give Yourself a Try. Now, you're listening to a special edition of the Fresh Air News Hour. We're talking in large part about COP26 that's happening in Glasgow. Now, equal to the discussion about who is in Glasgow is also who isn't there. Of course, we had a big conversation in the run-up to the summit about China and Russia, their leaders not being there. Now, of course, their delegations are there, aren't they? So... It is thought that they are engaging in these conversations and that they will be committing to things, as other countries will be. Just quickly on that point, Bridget, what's your view on the significance of Vladimir Putin from Russia and Xi Jinping from China not actually coming in person to the summit?
Well, I think it's disappointing, really. You know, I think this is a summit where we've seen people from all across the world. This is really, as we said before, you know, kind of make or break summit. And I think it's disappointing that they've decided not to be there. I think it's the symbolism of it more than anything. You know, they have sent delegations. There are things that they've done. You know, they've both signed the pledge to end deforestation by 2030, which is obviously really important, and I'm sure we'll talk about it later.
Yeah, we'll come on to talk about this pledge. It's so important.
But so they have done that, but I think it's more the symbolism of, you know, we need to see that countries are taking it seriously. And if the leaders themselves aren't attending, then I guess we start to question whether they're taking it seriously and whether they're seeing it as a world issue, you know, whether they're engaging to form strategies as a world and not just within their own countries. You know, what do you think about it?
It's absolutely about the symbolism. Mm-hmm. It really is. It's about the perception and the message it sends. I don't think anyone believes that they don't have the time in their schedules attend an international climate summit. They could make the time if they wanted to. They have the money to travel here. They have the resources to travel here.
Yeah.
It's a conscious choice and it's a political choice.
Yeah.
You don't see other countries, you know, countries who are not hostile to the climate agenda and who are not hostile to NATO members boycotting it in the same way, because it's not a formal boycott. They, as I said, they are being represented, but it is definitely about the symbolism, and people have of course they're not alone. Actually, Turkey has also done the same, which I think took President Erdogan of Turkey, which took a number of people by surprise, I think. But So that's the elected representatives. But returning, as we did about the royal family, returning to the conversation about those who are unelected, who are also involved in this movement, a huge figure who has actually emerged far more recently since Paris, actually, probably in the last 2 or 3 years, I'd say, is Greta Thunberg, Swedish schoolgirl Greta Thunberg, who is a climate activist with an audience and a following beyond which I think we've ever seen before.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's quite phenomenal in the crowd that she commands, isn't she?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the clips of her at Glasgow train station where she was kind of mobbed, you know. Everyone was just
like
so excited to see her,
yeah.
Which is really funny because I guess you think of the popular people in Glasgow being like Joe Biden or, you know, kind of world leaders. But no, it's this, you know, really young schoolgirl who, as we say, wasn't on the national scene before. And it's exciting. And I think it also shows that in a way, movements kind of need a leader or a face or someone that they can congregate around. You know, I think with all the movements that we've seen historically, there's been one person who's able to kind of talk to leaders and also talk to people, protesters. And I think we found that with Greta Thunberg. You know, I think she is the face of the current climate change crisis.
Let's just listen briefly to what she said to the BBC's Andrew Marr on Sunday.
Have you been asked to speak at this climate change conference, COP?
I don't know. It's very unclear. Not like officially.
Not officially. And why do you think that might be? Because a lot of people say there are not enough young voices at COP.
Yeah. Of course, this is not just a question about me. Mm-hmm. But I think that many people might be scared that if they invite too many radical young people, then that might make them look bad.
What strikes me about Greta Thunberg is that she does sort of all the right things by the book, doesn't she? She travels to these summits in sustainable ways.
Yeah.
I think it was 2 years ago that she actually travelled to New York by boat.
Yes.
Which was phenomenal. Yeah. You know, sailing across the Atlantic, this Swedish schoolgirl. And a lot of the criticism we've seen about COP, or at least that I've seen, has been the means by which leaders got there. Mm-hmm. We've all seen President Biden and, well, the US office of the US presidency's entourage.
With
COVID measures in place, his motor entourage is 85 cars
long.
And they were speeding down the M8 between Edinburgh and Glasgow just a few days ago. When it's non-COVID times, they're crammed in cars, so it's usually 45 cars only. But and that, I think rightly, that gets criticism. I think it does sometimes have the effect of distracting from the real problems.
Yes,
because do those 85 cars have a meaningful impact on the environment when actually the consequence of them taking him there could be world changing and, you know, generational? But Greta Thunberg does all these things in all the right ways, you know, in quote marks, and yet she gets criticised for, you know, speaking out of turn. You know, she's not elected. She shouldn't be taking these stances. She's too radical, all this stuff. Do you think the criticism of her is sometimes unfair?
Well, I think certainly it's probably easier to be outside government criticising it than be inside, because it must be true that, you know, she doesn't fully have all the kind of economic, you know, understanding or responsibilities that the world leaders themselves have. And some of them have criticised her for it, haven't they? I mean, you've had figures like Angela Merkel, Emmanuel Macron, people who really, you know, do believe in climate change, would normally be on her side, but have pointed out that it's, you know, it's quite easy to criticise, but it's not as easy to govern, you know, and to make those decisions. But I think in general, if she is facing criticism from world leaders, that's probably a sign she's doing something right. You know, I think we'd find it strange if people were saying, oh, you know, great, well done, good activism, because then she wouldn't be a radical, which is what she aims to be, you know?
Something that did annoy some world leaders and some commentators this week was this video that emerged of her in Glasgow.
You can shove your climate crisis up your arse. You can shove your climate crisis up your arse. You can shove your climate crisis. You can shove your...
Thank you, Greta. obviously, apologies for any language there. But It is important for her to take people with her, isn't she? Because standing on the sidelines, you know, she's growing up. She will, I imagine, take this on as a career, this activism role, because she is still in school, but she will take this on as a career, and she needs to be able to take world leaders with her, doesn't she?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. What do you think about her?
As I said, I think she gets unfair criticism, certainly, because people have this double standards of saying, well, if you cared that much about climate change, you wouldn't get a private jet to the summit. She doesn't get a private jet. She gets a boat or a train,
absolutely.
And she still remains to be criticised. But I also agree with you that it is far easier to stand outside of government and to watch on and to criticise and say what should be being done rather than being at the negotiating table talking about the sort of nitty-gritty of the changes that are going to be made. This summit needs to, and has, I think, so far, had a focus on those countries that aren't typically represented on the world stage. And indeed, those same countries are the ones that are faced with the immediate consequences of climate change. We heard this week at COP from Mia Mottley, who is the Prime Minister of Barbados. Let's hear what she had to say.
What must we say to our people living on the front line in the Caribbean, in Africa, in Latin America, in the Pacific, when both ambition and regrettably some of the needed faces at Glasgow are not present? What excuse should we give for the failure?
It is a problem, isn't it, that Western countries, quote unquote, northern, global north countries, those are the countries that have, in general, the power in the world, the money in the world, and those are the countries not currently facing immediate and wide-scale risks from climate. Do you think that if countries such as the UK, the USA, European countries were facing even greater threats from climate change than they currently are, action on climate might be quicker?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, sadly, the wealth of the world is not equally distributed. You know, sadly, it is with a certain amount of countries. And as it happens, it's not those countries currently facing the biggest threats. And therefore, action is slower. I mean, if you look at the pledge in 2009, you know, wealthy countries pledged about $100 billion a year to help the poorer nations by 2020. But just ahead of COP26 this year, the UK government released this plan that said that it actually looks unlikely that the target will be met, but the government is confident it will be met by 2023. And you kind of think that's it's just a kind of lack of awareness and understanding of the situations of the poorer countries. And definitely if the UK government were themselves in that situation, I think the things would be quite different.
It's about distance from decision making, isn't it? Because if this, let's say we had coastal towns around the UK being flooded this year, consistently every week, you know, because of rising sea levels and because of extreme weather, the political pressure that would put on the UK government would be unsustainable. They would be acting on it, not only by building immediate defences, sea defences, that kind of thing, but putting in place bold action to prove to the electorate, some people might consider this a cynical view, but it's true, to prove to the electorate that they care about them and that they should therefore stay in office. So I think that distance from who is making the decisions versus where the consequences are really being felt.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, especially if you look at meetings like the G7, the G20, you know, there are big decisions made there between the wealthy countries, but the poorer countries don't have a voice at those tables. You know, I mean, I think just before COP26, you did have the G20, where these incredibly powerful countries met in Italy. You had the world leaders meeting. You had them have dinners together, have banquets. And they said this is significant in determining the tone of COP26. But you think, but hold on, that's not quite fair because, you know, representatives from the poorer countries aren't there. And it doesn't seem fair that the wealthy countries should decide on, you know, the line they're going to take, you know, the handouts that they'll give the poor countries. It seems quite elitist. And it doesn't feel like a good use of the world's resources, really.
Well, let's talk about those decisions that have already been made at COP. One of the headlines from the last few days is that there's been an agreement to cut the emissions of methane, which is generally considered to be the second most important gas that contributes to global warming, to cut emissions of methane by 30% by 2030, which is, of course, you know, in a few months will be 2022. That's 8 years' time.
Oh, God. That is scary. Yeah.
That is soon. Crucially, however, of course, Russia and China have not signed up to that agreement. What was your reaction to India's announcement? India announced that it will end emissions of greenhouse gases by 2070. Now, Boris Johnson and COP President Alok Sharma wanted countries to commit to 2050. So that's 20 years later. But India is slowly becoming one of the most popular countries in the world, might one day become the most popular. It is still yet to fully develop the industry in its economy. Do you think that's a reasonable aim for the Indian economy? Do you think 2050 would have just been a ridiculously, you know, impossible target for them to meet? Or do you think that is going to be a problem?
I think I would have preferred them to commit to 2050 and then not be able to reach it. rather than move the goalposts to give themselves more time, if that makes sense. You know, I think if the kind of target had been closer, they would have been forced into more action within the next 30 years. But I think if you put it off to 2070, there's really kind of no impetus to change because it just feels like such a long time away. And also as well, the thing is that, you know, as with all of these summits, all of these meetings of world leaders, elections happen and these world leaders are not going to be in place for a long time. And, you know, if President Biden can commit to something that he thinks will happen in 2040, he won't be in office then. So, you know, I think you have to think in the short term as well as the long term. And you have to think if this leader agrees to this, they should have, you know, they should have the kind of impetus, the motivation to do it very soon, rather than to be able to kind of put it on the back foot, leave it for a while, leave that up to their successors kind of thing. You want kind of immediate action now, I think.
Well, let's listen to what President Biden had to say on the new pledge to halt deforestation by 2030.
Today, I'm announcing a new plan to conserve global forests, which will bring together a full range of U.S. government tools, diplomatic, financial, and policy, to halt forest loss, restore critical carbon sinks, and improve land management. This plan is the first of its kind, and taking a whole-of-government approach and working, in our case, with Congress to deploy up to $9 billion in U.S. funding through 2030 to conserve and restore our forests and mobilize billions more from our partners. It is this simple. Let's get to work. We can do this, and it'll have a generational impact. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was President Biden there committing to halting deforestation. Interesting, given that the conversation we've just had, he did mention the need to actually get those agreements ratified by Congress. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, if I may say so, he certainly won't be around in 2040 or 2050. And so it is important to get that legally binding. We're going to carry on with this, of course, more conversation about COP. But we're going to be taking a sort of Edinburgh student and a young people's perspective after this. But we're going to have some more music now.
Yep, this is T-shirt weather by Circle Waves. Again, just something to make us feel a little bit more summery on this very cold Edinburgh evening.
Baby, won't you come to bed? But I
Desert Weather by Circa Waves. I haven't heard that song in so long.
No.
It really is summary. Summary is the right word. Describe that.
It's very summary. I wish I was still sleeping till the early afternoon.
Oh God, I wish. So we said that we're going to be looking at this story from a more student-led perspective, from the perspective of young people. And we're actually lucky enough that this week, one of Fresh Air News' reporters, Eliska Sukhlebova, has been on the ground in Glasgow speaking to people in the green zone. She's been... So at COP, you have the blue zone, which is where all the official delegates and the world leaders are. But parallel to that, I think across the river, actually, is the green zone. It's a space still controlled by the UN, and it's where activists and campaigners and journalists are meeting to sort of discuss what's going on, react to it, put pressure on people. And it's a really interesting report. Let's hear what she has to say.
Hello, this is Eliska Sukhlebova, reporting for Fresh Air Radio from Glasgow. It's currently Wednesday, November 3rd, and I just arrived this morning from Edinburgh to volunteer in the COP26 Green Zone, which is in the Glasgow Science Centre. So far, the atmosphere in the city seems a bit chaotic. There's a lot of roadblocks, fences being put up to prevent people from going certain places. Lots of police officers who are clearly brought here from other parts of the UK because they speak in such London accents and they clearly have no clue where things in Glasgow actually are. There's also so many huge posters and banners put up related to the climate and shuttle buses powered on renewable energy. People with lanyards and face masks that say COP26, who just walk around looking really important, sometimes a bit confused as well. It's an exciting atmosphere, knowing that any time a president or prime minister or someone really important could walk past you. It's probably not going to happen, but the possibility seems to be there, and that's almost enough. There's two main sites at COP26, the blue zone, where all the official meetings happen. So that's where you would see politicians, members of NGOs, people from businesses engaging in discussions and negotiations. But you need accreditation to get there, so it's quite inaccessible for regular people. And then there's the green zone, which is accessible to the public as long as you book a free ticket in advance. Or you're like me and you volunteer there. There's lots of events and exhibitions and screenings going on and many organizations kind of presenting themselves and their work for the climate. In the green zone, I spoke to a student who came to Glasgow from Leeds to see COP26.
Okay, perfect. I'm Aishwarya, and I'm actually a student at the University of Leeds, and I'm doing my third year. I study sustainability and environmental management, so it's quite relevant, like, which is why I came here for COP26. I just kind of wanted to see what was going on and just kind of get a feel of the action and just be part of it, because like everyone was talking about how this is a really big conference this time around. So, and I was just glad to know that there was like a public place where people can come and like look at different things. So that's why I'm here.
I also spoke to a volunteer who has been helping here to make everything run smoothly in the green zone.
My name's Kat. I'm here volunteering at the COP26 event. I've come up from Warwick. I'm with National Grid, who is one of the sponsors of the event. It's been really good. I think there's been a lot of popularity over in the blue zone today. So once the event's finished there, we're hoping to get a bit more excitement here in the green zone. But there's so much science going on in this room, and there's been things that could entertain you for hours. So it's been really fun. Obviously, some of the stalls today have actually been very educational about renewable energy sources. And while obviously all the conversations are going on in the blue zone, I think it's really nice that the public can be over here trying to understand what it is that they're discussing and what they're trying to, the goal that they're trying to reach over there. It's been really nice just to meet people from all over the world and just help them enjoy their time in the green zone.
Nice. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
There's many organisations within the Green Zone showcasing their campaigns and kind of innovative responses to the climate crisis. So I interviewed one of them about their experience being in the Green Zone today.
Okay, cool. So, hello. Can you just tell me a bit about what you're doing here, what you've been doing today, how it's going?
Yeah, Yeah, so today we're hosting this exhibit in the Green Zone called My Climate Reality, where we're showing a virtual reality experience from activists on the front lines of climate change. So five different activists have filmed themselves and showing their lives and how they've been impacted by climate change. So our group is Mock COP 26, and we organized an international virtual version of COP last year when it was postponed. So today we're highlighting their voices here in the Green Zone and having conversations with people as they watch these videos.
There's also many protests going on at COP26, and I happened to experience one of them in the Green Zone. It was a group of people marching and singing a song. One of them was wearing a huge coat, which they've been carrying for thousands of kilometers on their way to Glasgow, and they marched here on foot.
Everyone, including the world leaders who are gathered here making decisions, to put on this coat and feel the weight and the warmth of our hopes.
All right, that's all from me for now. I hope you enjoyed this report from Glasgow, and goodbye.
That was Fresh Air News' Eliska Sukhochlebova reporting live from Glasgow. That was fascinating.
Yeah, definitely.
That really was enjoyable, because of course everything we see on the news is the world leaders talking and the negotiators and the big agreements that have been signed. And it really is nice to hear from other people on the ground, people far more similar in our age, and what they're getting up to at COP. And so that was fantastic. And of course, we will be continuing to cover COP in the coming weeks and the coming months in terms of what is announced and how these targets are achieved. Now, in other news, today has been a whirlwind day in the House of Commons in Westminster. Essentially, this is one of those stories that is dominating the news, yet I sort of struggle to understand, and I really have to look into it to understand everything that's going on. This is my understanding. Owen Paterson, he's a Tory MP, he's a former minister. He lobbied the government, so essentially he asked the government to do things. He asked ministers to help him when it comes to legislation on behalf of companies. Companies paid him to do that, which is illegal. He's not allowed to do that under the standards of the House of Commons, because paying for access to government is most people would consider morally wrong and is unfair, because each citizen does not have equal access. He was found to have committed wrongdoing by an independent committee within Parliament. The government then yesterday tried to sort of protect him, and they put a vote before the House and said, should this committee be temporarily disbanded? Should we create a new committee that deals with standards in Parliament? And the House, given that there is a Conservative majority, said yes to that. Now, today, the government U-turned on that because there was significant outrage, which Jacob Rees-Mogg sums up here.
That last night's vote has created a certain amount of controversy. It is important that standards in this House are done on a cross-party basis. The House voted very clearly yesterday to show that it is worried about the process of handling these complaints and that we would like an appeal system, but that change would need to be on a cross-party basis, and that is clearly not the case.
That's Jacob Rees-Mogg, leader of the House of Commons, just there. So they U-turned. The committee will now not be disbanded. This afternoon, in the wake of the controversy, Owen Paterson has resigned. It's all a bit of a mess, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's quite crazy to watch it all happen, really.
It doesn't give a great image of the House of Commons.
No.
Which many people agree with on all sides of the House. Here's Labour's Chris Bryant.
As we say in the report, each of Mr. Paterson's several instances of paid advocacy would merit a suspension of several days. But the fact that he has repeatedly failed to perceive his conflict of interest and used his privileged position as a Member of Parliament to secure benefits for two companies for whom he was a paid consultant is even more concerning. He has brought the House into disrepute. A Conservative colleague, whom I respect a great deal, said to me on Monday that justice should always be tempered by mercy. I agree. But justice also demands no special favours. These are the precedents that we considered. Patrick Mercer was suspended.
Just for people listening to that clip, Bridget, you said it was so dramatic. It has been a dramatic day, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think kind of the interesting thing that strikes me about it, really, is that maybe the government, because, you know, they have quite a large majority in the House of Commons, kind of tend to think that they can kind of get away with things, they can pass certain things, because if a couple of Conservative MPs don't vote their way, it doesn't really matter the way that it did in, say, the coalition, for example. But I guess what this has really shown is that, you know, people are really paying attention, and you can't just get away with passing things. Even if the vote is passed, there'll still be public opposition. And that's really a lot more powerful than I suppose the government gave it credit for.
And I think the long-term problem for the Conservative Party here is that in the last few years, especially at the 2019 general election, they had an extremely powerful message, which was, we are the people's government. We are on your side. And that, through a combination of their Brexit policy, through that, those sort of two welded together, that is what they did to win over those former Labour voters, many of them in the north of England. Mm-hmm. And it is that message, people's government, representing brand new swathes of the country, when held up alongside this image of sleaze, some would say corruption, that really will pose a challenge to them if put forward appropriately by opposition at the next election, because all parties have their problems. But I do think that is going to be the main one. I can't quite believe we're saying it, but that's already the end of the show. It's gone so quickly, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's flown by, honestly.
Absolutely flows by. Just before we end, you do have another show on Fresh Air Radio. Do you want to give that little plug? Go
thank
on.
You, yeah. It's called A Chatty Time, and it is on Mondays from 4 to 5 p.m. and on Fresh Air as well.
Fantastic. Well, Bridget, thank you so much for being my co-host this week.
You've been
wonderful.
Been really
it's been a busy show focusing on COP and also that stuff on Parliament in the last few minutes as well. I will be back next week. I'd like to just thank a few people just before we go. Finn Marsden edited a lot of the audio that you heard during this show. Thank you to him. Of course, Eliska reporting from Glasgow. Show wouldn't have been the same without that. And as always, if you want to get in touch with me about future shows, if you think you might have a story that's relevant, then please email news@freshair.radio. That's all for this week. We're going to leave you with some music. We started the show by talking about James Bond, Boris Johnson's reference to James Bond in his opening speech. And we're going to leave with a song called I Wish I Was James Bond by Scouting for Girls. Enjoy. This has been the Fresh Air News Hour. I've been Ollie Lewis, and I'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Not enough for the both of us, it seems. So I wish I was James Bond just for the day. Kissing all the girls, blow the bad guys away. And I wish I was James Bond just for the day. Kissing all the girls, blow the bad. Thank you. Mr. Bond, I've been expecting you. Martini in your hand and that eyebrow that you move. Don't take this the wrong way, I know it might sound odd. I'm the next 00, I'm the right man for the job. So I wish I was James Bond, just for the day. Kissing all the girls, blow the bad guys away. And I wish I was James Bond, just for the day. Kissing all the girls, blow the bad guys away. I've a license, I've a license, I've a license to thrill. I've a license, I've a license, I've a license to kill. I've a license, I've a license, I've a license to thrill. I've a license, I've a license, I've a license to kill. I wanted to be you, I wanted to be you, I wanted to be someone else. I wanted to be you, I wanted to be you, I wanted to be someone else. And I wish I was James Bond, just for the day. Kissing all the girls, blow the bad guys away. And I wish I was James Bond, just for the day.